This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden returned to the United States Wednesday night following his visit to Europe and meetings in Switzerland with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Biden and Putin exchanged cordial words and modest steps on arms control and diplomacy, but emerged from their much-anticipated Swiss summit Wednesday largely where they started, with deep differences on human rights, cyber attacks, election interference, and more. Biden said the next several months would serve as a test of whether relations between the two countries can improve. Biden also emphasized the last thing Putin wants now is a Cold War. Meantime, Putin said Wednesday that jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny got what he deserved when he was sentenced to prison. Navalny, Putin's most prominent political foe, was arrested in January when he returned from Germany, where he had been treated at a Berlin hospital for months while recovering from a poisoning. Navalny contends Russian agents applied the nerve agent Novichok to his underwear in August, a claim Moscow has denied. Then in February, Navalny was handed a 2.5-year prison term for violating a suspended sentence he had been given after a 2014 embezzlement conviction he says was politically motivated. And China has launched the first 3-man crew Thursday on its mission to the space station, which is now under construction. The astronauts traveling from the space launch near the Gobi Desert. This is VOA News. The European Union announced it is recommending that nations lift COVID-19 restrictions on tourists from the United States. And in other news, France announced it will remove requirements to wear face masks outdoors and end nightly coronavirus curfews 10 days early. The announcement comes as France reported about 30,900 daily virus cases on average, down from more than 35,000 in March. On Tuesday, vaccinations were open to 12 to 18-year-olds as part of a push to protect the nation as restrictions are gradually lifted. Vaccination efforts in the United States have become slowed, even as a new variant is trying to take hold. Federal health authorities are warning of the rise of the Delta variant, first discovered in India, in the particular pockets of the United States with low vaccination rates. During a call for governors on Monday, the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said the Delta variant has increased from 2.7% of all cases in the U.S. in May to 9.7% this month, according to details provided by the Washington Governor's Office. In Texas, the rolling average of newly confirmed infections has roughly doubled since May 31st to nearly 2,000 a week. India's iconic Taj Mahal Monument reopened Wednesday as a devastating second wave of the coronavirus pandemic begins to slow, prompting authorities to ease restrictions. A steep decline in new infections this month has encouraged major cities such as New Delhi and Mumbai to reopen vast swaths of the economy, including tourist sites, hotels, shopping malls, and restaurants. But after reports came in of crowded markets and packed rail stations, doctors warned of a possible resurgence. Delhi was among the worst-hit cities, as acute shortages of oxygen and hospital beds led to a public health crisis in the city of 20 million that it never had seen before. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com. Additional information on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 17, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's government denies it is trying to pacify the country's vocal human rights defenders coalition.
His appointment of one or two individuals from the civil society organization does not represent a stifling of the entire civil society space, because the civil society space in Malawi is robust and vibrant and is bigger than two individuals.
Zimbabwean prison authorities released New York Times freelance reporter. Concerns over rising road accidents and deaths in Guinea-Bissau. Syrian refugees enrich Somalia's culture and contribute to the economy. And a Sudan peace activist wants international pressure to force an agreement.
South Sudanese government, they're doing very well, but it is not enough. It needed engagement from America and from European Union to make an agreement.
Able University students say those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesperson for Malawian President Lazaro Chakwera says the government is not trying to pacify human rights activists in the country by offering their leaders foreign service positions. The Malawi Yansa Times online newspaper reported Wednesday that President Chakwera has offered some leaders of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, HRDC, positions to serve in various Malawi diplomatic missions, including Addis Ababa, Brussels, Germany, and Washington, D.C., as a way of keeping the group quiet. The HRDC has played an important role in human rights issues in Malawi, particularly the fight against corruption. Sean Kampondeni, Director of Communications for President Chakwera, says the appointment of one or two individuals from the civil society does not represent a stifling of the entire civil society space, because the civil society in Malawi is robust and vibrant.
Malawian Foreign Service is in desperate need of professionals who are able to represent the country objectively and putting national interest first above political interests. And the president has scoured across the society of Malawi for qualified individuals without regard to where those qualified individuals are found. The HRDC has done an excellent job in being a critical voice that provides oversight on matters of governance. In fact, the president has been very supportive of the role that the civil society organizations in the country play, including the likes of HRDC, which he has interacted with, advocated for since the time he was leader of opposition in parliament. And so his appointment of one or two individuals from the civil society organization does not represent a stifling of the entire civil society space, because the civil society space in Malawi is robust and vibrant and is bigger than two individuals whom the president has found qualified to represent their country abroad.
The article says that there have been appointments made, say, for example, of HRDC members like Luke Tembo, Billy Mayaya, Happy Wango. So does that mean President Chakwera has made some appointments from the membership of the HRDC?
Yes, the president has made appointments from the membership of the HRDC, but that membership is vast, because the HRDC is able to orchestrate demonstrations and protests that are large in size across the country. And so the appointment of three individuals from its vast membership does not affect the critical role that they play as an oversight and watchdog organization.
So what about HRDC leader Gift Trapense?
What about him?
Was he also appointed?
I'm not aware of any appointment that's been made of the leader of the HRDC, because the names that the president has appointed the Foreign Service have been channeled through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and are coming out in a cascaded fashion. So I know that some names have been released, and there are other names that will be released shortly, because they are all subject to confirmation by the Public Appointments Committee of Parliament. And so I cannot speak to who has been appointed, except the names that have duly been released publicly and the names that have been confirmed by Parliament.
So once again, your government does not intend to break down the HRDC, except that you would appoint people who you feel can serve the country.
That is the point. And in fact, what better candidates to represent the country abroad than those who have demonstrated to be strong voices that can speak truth to power? What better representatives for the Malawian people than those who can call home and speak to their president without fear or favor, because they have already demonstrated that they are capable of being a critical voice to government.
Sean, thank you so much. It's always very nice to speak with you.
You're welcome, James.
Sean Campodeni is Director of Communications for Malawian President Lazaro Chakwera. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. A Sudan peace activist who attended the just concluded talks in South Sudan's capital, Juba, between Sudan's transitional government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, led by Abdel Aziz Al-Helu, says the differences between the two sides are so wide that it would take pressure from either the United States or the European Union for the two sides to find common ground. Mohamed Saleh says the main point of contention is the separation of religion and government. Al-Helu, the largest rebel group in Sudan, prefers the separation of religion from the state. Saleh says while the South Sudan government is doing a superb job in facilitating the talks, a non-Sudanese outside pressure group will quickly make the two sides reach an agreement.
I think they agree of 90% from the problems, and there is a 20% from issues. They don't agree in it because this is very difficult issues. I think the transition government need more time to make a decision because these issues is very difficult and complicated for them. And that is the reason why this dialogue is moved on to last Monday.
You said they agreed on 90% of the issues. What are some of the issues that make up the 10%?
The first issues is secularism and how we rule the country in the future. That is the first and the difficult issues, because the transition government cannot make a decision in this issue. The second issue is the military issue. There's a lot of military groups, and they must be a one in Sudanese government. These two issues, in my opinion, is the biggest two issues in making the agreement very difficult.
The issue of the military, why is this a difficult one?
It is a difficult because there is many militaries, if the name is so right, the government military. There is a Janjaweed named Tam Seria. Yes, there is every group from the rebellion have their own military, and this all must be in the end of the transaction period, a one military. And that is very difficult. Here is very complicated issues to discuss, to make a decision, and that is not easy to make it from the transactions government side.
We know that Al-Helu, the leader of the SPLM North, had been concerned about the issue of religion. Was that resolved?
No, not resolved. The secularism of the country, of the state, is the big issue. They don't make here any agreement. I think a lot of talking will be followed in this issue, because two, three groups from the transactions government, they don't want to separate religion from the country, and that is a problem here now.
But Al-Helu, he wants the separation of religion and government. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Mohamed, what do you think? What is your own observation as someone who came to the talks to observe? What do you come up with? Do you think there's a possibility some agreement will be reached?
I think not yet. It will take more time till they reach an agreement. I think it is difficult now in this two very far position between Al-Helu and between the government. It needs more pressure from Western society and the government to see they must make more possibility in the issue of religion, in the issue of military. These two issues will be not solved without pressure from USA or from the European Union. The South Sudanese government, they're doing very well, but it is not enough. it needed engagement from America and from European Union to make as soon as possible an agreement.
Mohamed Saleh is a Vienna-based Sudanese peace activist. You are speaking with us from South Sudan's capital, Juba. Zimbabwean prison authorities released New York Times freelancer Jeffrey Moyo on Wednesday after the High Court granted him bail. Police arrested the 37-year-old in May, alleging that he helped two of the U.S. newspaper journalists illegally enter Zimbabwe. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Moyo's detention sparked concerns from Western diplomats and press freedom groups.
Moyo was released Wednesday, one day after the High Court in Bulawayo, the country's second largest city, granted him bail. His attorney, Doug Coulthard, a Zimbabwean human rights lawyer, said Moyo should have been released a day earlier, but prison officials noted a problem with the warrant of liberation. Speaking from Bulawayo via a messaging app, Coulthard voiced anger about his client being detained by an extra day.
It's a typical tactic which is used to extend the detention of prisoners after they've been granted bail, which is why the legal team specifically requested to see the warrant of liberation before leaving the magistrate's court. That request was denied, and when the prison officials started claiming that there was an error on it late in the evening last night, again the legal team requested to see that warrant of liberation. That request was again denied.
Government officials were not immediately available to comment on Moyo's case. Moyo was arrested on May 26th along with a Zimbabwe Media Commission official, Tabang Manika, for allegedly processing fake accreditations for two South African-based Times journalists who entered Zimbabwe last month and have since been deported. Western diplomats and international press freedom groups voiced concerns about the arrests. A lower court had denied the two bail, saying they were a danger to national security because they helped U.S. journalists interview Zimbabweans without the government's permission. Coulthard again.
The state's papers on appeal, essentially the state admits that the grounds that they advanced for opposing his bail in the magistrate's court were baseless and frivolous, and that they essentially don't have any case against him and that he's not a national security threat as they alleged.
The government has dismissed accusations that Zimbabwe is disregarding media freedom. On social media, the Information Ministry Secretary, Dabani Ngimangwana, said the two had been arrested for breaking immigration laws. Tabani Moyo of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, who is no relation to Jeffrey Moyo, said he welcomed Jeffrey Moyo's release and was looking forward to the trial.
The trial of Jeffrey Moyo is a trial on fairness, in that you are only guilty when proven such. Fairness is a key element in discharge of our judiciary services. So we are saying it's fairness on trial, that is out on bail, is the first step in that process, and we hope that to the conclusion of the case, fairness will be at the center of the trial, as it should be to every Zimbabwean.
No trial dates have been set for Manika and Moyo. The two men face up to 10 years in prison if convicted. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 17. Since the war in Syria broke out a decade ago, refugees have fled to countries in the Middle East and Europe, as well as to countries in Africa that face instability, like Somalia. And as Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, Somali officials say Syrian refugees are enriching the host nation culturally and economically.
Zakaria Azarkan is a Syrian refugee who fled civil war in his homeland 2 years ago to seek opportunities in Somalia, a country that is still recovering from internal conflict. Now, he is chef and manager of Al Warda Ashamia, a popular Syrian restaurant in Mogadishu. He says he expects other Syrians will find opportunities here and open new projects, even though Somalia is still emerging from war. There are Syrian dentists who have already opened clinics, he says, and other doctors with various specializations who operate medical centers in Mogadishu. Azarkani's restaurant serves as a meeting place for Mogadishu's Syrian community. Recent arrivals to the city come here for orientation. 13-year-old Mohamed Musa and his family arrived in Mogadishu just a few days ago. They dine with Somali locals who are now accustomed to Syrian cuisine. Musa says that he urges all Syrian immigrants or even Somalis to come to this restaurant because the food here is irresistible. He says it feels as if he was back in his home country. Dr. Mahmoud Saleh is among the Syrian refugee medical professionals offering their skills to a country that lost most of its skilled workers to civil war, buffered and years of lawlessness. Saleh has been in Somalia for the past 4 years and has fully integrated with the local community. The dental surgeon runs one of the best equipped clinics in Mogadishu and is credited for performing safe, successful operations. Saleh says he has settled here with his family. Since he has been in Mogadishu for 4 years with his wife and children, he says he considers himself a Somali citizen. He said his children are now attending Somali schools. Saleh says his family also consider themselves as Somali. Syrians who chose to find refuge in Somalia away from their war-torn country may have been driven by the good historical relations between the two countries. In their peace times, both countries shared similar political ideologies. Abdul Wahab Sheikh is a Somali scholar and an expert on international relations and culture. He says there has been a long-standing relationship between the two nations that began during the military regime that ruled Somalia and Ba'ath-led government in Syria. These strong bilateral relations remained, and after Syria became engulfed in civil war, some opted to come to Somalia, where there are no visa restrictions for Syrian citizens. There is no official data on the number of Syrian refugees living in Mogadishu, and not all are as successful as Azarkan and Saleh. What is clear is that many of these refugees are making a positive contribution to the local economy and culture. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Guinea-Bissau's roadways are notoriously poorly maintained, and recently accidents with multiple deaths have been making headlines in the country. One incident resulted in 14 deaths in May. Member of Parliament Dionisio Pereira spoke with Reiki Shryak about the worrying number of road accidents and deaths in the country and what he thinks needs to be done to improve road safety in Guinea-Bissau.
What's happened now is like our road, 99%, is not good. We have got two problems on the road. Then at the moment, we are getting more problems because of the Kashua night. We have the big cars that are bringing the Kashua night to the south, and then they no one to control, no rules, or no one to control the speed on the road, and then they are driving without respect any rules. And then all the time we are having the accidents on the road because no one respects the rules. Also, the road is not good, and the government is not control anyone. And then this is the main problem that we are at the moment.
Is there a problem with the conditions of the road as well? Does that contribute to these accidents?
One of the problem is the condition of the road, and another problem is the condition of there is no control. No one control our roads. No one control the cars that are on the road. Most of the cars, no license to drive. Most of the cars, they have no license. And then the one part of the problem is the roads. Another part is the cars and driving.
There has been a heightened presence of police in the roads in the country, especially since the COVID restrictions. Why isn't this helping, this heightened presence of police? Why isn't that helping actually regulate the roads, the drivers better?
No, first of the thing is that we in Guinea Bissau, you know, at the moment, we still saying that there is no control. There is no control. Anyone else is driving without license. And then they do what they want on the route, okay? And government just taking money, asking money from them, not control them to respect the rules. The rules drive. Our rules in the south, they are not good. No one is working on taking them better than right now.
What do you think needs to be done to solve the problem?
To solve the problem, I think, first of all, we need to have serious government, because one of our problems is corruption.
That was Dionisio Pereira, a member of parliament in Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking with Ricky Stryer from the capital, Bissau. People with disability in Liberia say they are often marginalized and discriminated against. As Rita Jilabwe reports from Monrovia, university students say their campuses are not disabled friendly.
In 2012, Liberia signed and ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. The nation also developed an act that established a National Commission on Disabilities to address the rights of people in that category. However, legal protection of the rights of disabled people is still very weak. A physically challenged student at the University of Liberia's Fenda campus, Beatrice Sender, says she finds it difficult attending classes. She says almost all of her classes are on the first and second floors of one of the lecture halls.
Classes being hostels or with a disabled is very challenging for us. Sometimes if we reach the building to even get hostels, we will sit and wait for our colleagues there. For the people well dressed up, somebody, not everybody get patient. When we beg to sometimes say, no, I'm not able to rush and go in the class.
Like Beatrice, Perkins' boy is also physically challenged. He heads the University of Liberia Association of Disabled Students. Boy says university and college campuses in the country are not disabled friendly.
The University of Liberia campus is extremely unconducive for persons with disabilities. The environment was structured in a way to exclude persons with disabilities. So almost like it's a systematic denial of the person's right to education.
Elijah Mayon is a visually impaired and an advocate at the Liberia Christian Association of the Blind. He says members of his community are not guaranteed formal education at institutions of higher learning.
There are a lot of instances where blind persons have had to leave their places of residence to go somewhere else to find an institution at which they can attend, because higher institutions of learning are refusing those with disabilities. That EAS service is not a form of discrimination.
Mayon also blames the government for lack of support to the community.
Persons with disabilities have not been supported by this government. The pro-poor agenda that promised to pay special attention to vulnerable people, to those who are indigent, to those who are at the margin of society. Unfortunately, this framework has to a significant extent failed to benefit persons with disabilities.
Deputy Director for Administration at the National Commission on Disabilities, Fala Boyman, agrees that persons with visual impairments are not given special attention at universities in Liberia.
There is none that is trained to teach visually impaired person, none. But what we do, we have our tape recorder. So when we go in class, we sit at the desk, we put our recorder on, and recall the lecture given to us.
Article 24 of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities stipulates that all countries take steps to ensure that persons with disabilities have access to an inclusive, quality, and free primary and secondary education on an equal basis with others in their communities. All efforts for comments from the Liberian government were unsuccessful. Rita Jirabwe, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you will have a very good day.